Ready?
Great show. Anyway, we're going to hear something now from the Beastie Boys.
Our evening began in Peter Seychelles' comfortable study in his New York townhouse.
No sleep till Brooklyn!
Yeah. Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, and Staten. From the Battery to the top of Manhattan.
Hey, yo, Europa!
Yeah.
If you want a better go eat tonight, kick it, roof down, I put my roof down. So we gonna kick it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Brouhaha. My name is Jim Shear, and today we have a very, very special guest. Billy Joel is considered the fifth Beastie Boy. If that is the case, this man has to be in the top 10. Graffiti artist, graphic artist, pop artist, artist, a man shouted out by Sir Paul McCartney, Say Adams.
Wow. Okay. How you doing, Jim?
And you wanted to do this correct. You didn't want to do it over the phone.
No. I want it to sound good. I mean, you know, these stories are priceless.
You do sound good. Well, your mic might actually sound better than my mic today.
That's probably good for the listeners, I would think.
But can we go through the work you've done with the Beastie Boys? And then we'll go through the work you've done in just the hip-hop genre,
okay.
Hip-hop culture.
Well, you know, the earliest thing that I've done that people, you know, may remember or may not, depending on how, you know, young or old they are, was the very first graffiti logo that, you know, most of the time if people have seen it, it would probably be on the first Cookie Puss 12-inch.
Where they're all skipping together, right?
Yeah, so I did that, and Dave Skilkin did the design along with myself, and so, you know, that was, 1983?
I've heard a story where you kind of came up with the graffiti logo, and then Dave Skilkin kind of refined it.
No, wow. We got to clear that up. No, you know, it was weird. Obviously,
but before you go on, let me say that it has changed.
Oh yeah.
And now it's peerless.
I've refined it many times over the years, but you know the way it originally happened was, I first met Adam Horovitz and Dave Skilkin back in 1983, and they approached me outside Danceteria nightclub about the idea of designing a logo for them. You know, for the Beastie Boys. And so basically Skilkin knew who I was because he wrote graffiti and he was kind of, you know, loosely involved in the, you know, graffiti scene. And, you know, they basically approached me and said, you know, hey, you know, I'm Adam, I'm Dave. And he says, you know, we have a band called Beastie Boys. And I had heard of them because Cookie Puss was, you know, like a hot single at that point that was being played in the clubs and whatnot. So we talked about, you know, what they wanted. And he said, you know, we want something, you know, that was kind of, you know, graffiti-ish. And, you know, at the time, people weren't using the term hip-hop, so that wasn't even a thought. And, you know, I came up with this sort of graffiti lettering. And then when we were putting the 12-inch together, because Dave was an artist, we decided to work on it together. So I did the logo, and he, you know, focused on dealing with the graphics, and he did all the lettering for the back cover. So that's what happened. We collaborated to do the 12-inch together.
But you were always refining it, right?
Yeah. Well, the idea was, you know, as time went on, like everything, every time we did something, you know, rather than, you know, run out to find a copy shop, you just redraw it, you know, because that was faster than anything else. So, you know, that's why if you've ever seen early flyers, there's like different variations floating around everywhere, but I, you know, did them all. And so, you know, it was always a lot of fun doing that. And the idea of saving time never really occurred to me.
And the current one, though, that is done with a computer program, I'm
assuming. Yeah. And, you know, like I said, you know, over the years, you know, I played around with a bunch of different variations on it, whether it was, you know, hand lettering or, you know, some form of type design. But, you know, the guys always give you a lot of space to, you know, do what you need to do and to be as creative as you can be. So
and say, I don't know if you've been to the Brouhaha website, but if it were not for you, we would not have a logo.
Wow.
Because we use that graffiti font, and we also use the sardine can.
Okay.
Which is actually, we changed it into an iPod.
But
you did the Hello Nasty album cover too, right?
Yeah. I designed that with Bill McMullen. I mean, I art directed and he designed it, but you know, he was working with me at the time. And the guys called me in because they wanted to design the cover and concept themselves. They really wanted to do it all. And that was, you know, one of the first times when they really, you know, kind of took control and decided that they were going to design the cover themselves. So that was the idea. And so they called me in, you know, mostly to kind of kick around ideas with them because, you know, this is still kind of like the early days of like computer design. And so, you know, they weren't as efficient as they are now, let's say. So, you know, we were all sitting there kind of kicking around ideas for the cover. And they'd had a completely different direction that they were going in. The idea was they wanted something that looked like a 60s, 70s sort of like jazz album cover. And so, you know, Adam would show me all these records and all these images, and he was like, okay, you know, could we try to do something centered around this? But, you know, after we started listening to the music a little bit more, and they were still in the process of recording, we came up with the idea of doing this space background. And they just kept talking about, you know, this sardine can. And so then all of a sudden we were like, okay, we're going to do the, you know, a sardine can. And it wasn't even clear that they were going to be in the sardine can at that point. But once we decided that that was going to happen, we went out and we bought all these different sardine cans because they knew they wanted like the vintage kind with the little key and stuff.
Right.
And if you go to most supermarkets right now, you know, they don't have them that way anymore. It's kind of like the pull tab. So it's a, you know, a quicker and easier, you know, format. So we went and we found all these different sardine cans and we kind of looked at them. And after we lined them up, we're like, okay, now how are we going to make this a reality?
Now, do you still have that example sardine can lying around somewhere?
I do. You know, and it's funny that you should mention that because I literally just saw it last week. Like, you know, and this is a mock-up that was, you know, before we had the Hello Nasty thing, the idea was they were kicking around a bunch of different names, and one of the names was this always happens to me. This always I have it right on the tip of my tongue, and then when I'm gonna say it, it kind of
an alternate name for Hello Nasty.
Yeah. The idea was it was going to be called, and I just looked at this. I can't believe it. We'll have to come back to this, and I'll edit it.
Written down on a notepad somewhere.
Wait,
back to the cover art. I also heard that originally it was supposed to have a rotating circle on the cover. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Well, there was the one of the album covers that we looked at was kind of like a, what do you call it? It's not a, it's like a wonder wheel or whatever where you can kind of, help me.
Well, not the like barnyard wheel where it's like sheep.
No. Well, yeah. Like for little kids, like that sort of thing. Like, that's why I was saying wonder wheel. But the idea was that it was going to have rotating artwork. But what happens is whatever's on the cover and somehow like, depending on how you rotate the wheel, it still fits into, you know, the overall design, so it doesn't look strange. It's just a different color. Like the cover would be, you know, black and white or whatever, and then the color part would be, you know, whatever you would rotate it towards. Like, for example, you know, if it was a pie or a slice of pie or something, you know, and you'd rotate it and it'd just be different fruit in the little window, so that sort of thing.
But that never happened. I'm guessing because it was too expensive.
No, we did like paper mock-ups, but you know, at the end of the day, they just ended up, you know, liking this other thing a little bit more. So we kind of went away from that, but we came up with a couple of different ideas.
What were the other ideas?
Well, you know, naturally, I can't think of the first one. You know, I keep thinking that it said intergalactic, but it wasn't that. It was something like that, though. It was like, you know, it was Another Dimension. That's what it is.
Right? Another was so, going to be the album title?
Yeah, so it was
gonna Another Dimension.
It was going to be called Another Dimension, and so that was the thing. We did mock-ups for that, and I had to visualize it just now, and so I saw it. So, yeah, we did mock-ups that said Another Dimension. And we really kind of went down to the wire, and we were going to go to print with that. And then at the last minute, you know, they had, like, three options. It was, like, Another Dimension, Hello Nasty, and something else. And, you know, and I didn't know what Hello Nasty was. But then, you know, later on they explained it, you know, if you call right. Nasty Little Man, that's the way they answer the phone.
Hello, well, Nasty.
And I, you know, didn't know that because I'd never called.
You didn't need to call.
Right. So,
you call the Beastie Boys directly. Right.
So that was how that came about. And, you know, like I said, you know, when we first did it, I didn't really understand, you know, I just thought it was such a strange name. But then it made sense and it made Steve Martin happy, so...
And it seems like the whole album was centered around that intergalactic theme.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing Intergalactic was in the can. They knew it was going to be a big hit single.
Well, you know, I don't think they ever know how that's going to, you know, pan out. But, you know, but what happened was once we had the cover concept, then we kind of sat down, you know, and they had this this kind of like vintage like space catalog. And that's where all those graphics from the inside came from, you know, the space catalog. And then the other part, like Bill McMullen, you know, the designer that worked with me at the time, he, you know, drew, you know, that space station in Photoshop. I mean, he's a master illustrator. And he just, you know, just went completely nuts. And then the more he did, then the guys would kind of look at it and then they come up with ideas and they would literally just sit there and just kick around ideas for hours. And, you know, and there's nothing scarier than visualizing something and having somebody sitting next to you that can, you know, realize it. And Bill is that kind of guy. He's a, you know, a sci-fi nerd anyway. So he was really excited about the opportunity to do this. And so I just let him go. I was like, do your thing.
Oh, so let's list off the other Beastie stuff you've worked on. We've got the... Of course, the old school graffiti font logo.
Yeah, but you know what? Surprisingly enough, if you consider how long I've known them, I haven't done that much. And
okay, let's go through. You've got that. We've got Hello Nasty.
Yeah.
The Peace Unity limited edition sneakers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Don't forget
true.
About that.
Yeah.
The cheeseburger shirt.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, one of the things, like, if you look at the... whatever the greatest hits record was called, I forget right now.
Sounds of Science?
No.
Solid Gold Hits.
Yeah, Solid Gold Hits. On the back of that, there's a photograph that Josh Choose took, I think, in 1983 or 1984. And they're, you know, sitting down up against this brick wall. And so I did this, you know, long Beastie Boys piece. And that was across the street from this club called Danceteria on 21st Street that, you know, like a lot of things in New York, is no longer there. But that was one of the things that I was most proud of, because it's one of the few times when you see Kate Schellenbach in a photograph with the other guys, you know, from the early days. So it was nice that they used that. And
so she was in that photo?
I think she was. You know,
okay,
the, you know,
I mean,
the
you only see the... The Beastie Boys, and then it's the
maybe,
brick wall with the track listing.
You know, see, this is the problem when you talk to me. It's like I got, like, all these things in my head that, you know, may or may not have, you know, like, been realized in real life. And so I'm thinking about things, and then I'm talking about it. And then, you know, if somebody's at home looking at it, they're like, all I see is a brick wall. But the reason I mention it is because recently I've been looking at a lot of those early photographs that she was in, and it's just really cool to kind of go back and, you know, look at the band from the early stages and think about where they are now, so.
Which we will talk about.
Okay.
And say we're going to take a quick break. Okay. And just to let you know, I take these breaks to break up the files so nothing crashes.
Okay.
And then there's a nice little Beastie commercial thrown in there.
Okay.
So we will take a break, and we will be back with more Brouhaha right after this.
I want to take this minute to introduce you to my people.
The C to the A, that's the boss. The rhymes that we boss on the topic of lust.
It does
does go well with the chicken.
The Brew Ha Ha.
We have returned on the Brew Ha Ha, Jim Shear, joined by Zay Adams. Thank you for having me over too, Zay.
Oh no, this is great. You know, like I said, you know, it's just nice to get an opportunity to tell some of these stories, even if you know, people have heard some of them before. But you know, I don't think that, you know, anybody's heard, you know, some of these before, because, you know, I don't go on record too often when it comes to talking about, you know, the early years. So it's a lot of fun to get a chance to do that.
Because like I said, many people associate you with the Beastie Boys.
Well, yeah. Well,
I mean, the inside fans, they consider you one of the inside circle, and they might not even know about your art career, which I would like to talk about, but you were going to say something else.
No, I was just saying that, you know, that mostly has to do with what I was saying before, was that even though I've known the guys for a very long time, I haven't done as much work with them as people think. If you think about, you know, the fact that we've known each other for, you know, like 28 years, that's a long time. And they put out, you know, a bunch of records. And a lot of the reason that I haven't done stuff is because I was busy, you know, doing my own stuff, you know, for, you know, Def Jam and for, you know, like Puffy's, like, you know, Bad Boy Records and, you know, everybody else that was putting out music. So, you know, it was nice not to have to always, you know, work on stuff with those guys. You know, whenever I would see them, we would just hang out. So it was, you know, a nice change of pace. And, you know, I just got busy as time went on. And whenever we would come together, it would just be, you know, to hang out and just, you know, kick it and do stuff like, you know, people do with their friends.
And what's your favorite thing that you've done with them?
I have to, I think that very first logo, and, you know, we made those very first t-shirts, you know, just a white t-shirt with the red Beastie Boys graffiti logo, and that's still kind of my favorite thing, because it was just, you know, a simpler and purer time. You know, we made them, we were selling them for like, you know, $5 at the show, and, you know, it was before, you know, all the big fancy merchandising and everything got, you know, really, you know, crazy and expensive, and it was just a simple time, and it's just nice to be able to do stuff like that and not have to deal with the machine that goes along with, you know, making music and, you know, making decisions. And, you know, I understand that that has to happen, but I just enjoy being able to do stuff and not having to go through any red tape to, you know, get it done.
So can we go through your resume right now?
Well, you know, like I said, you know, for people that don't know, when I first started, I started out in the early 80s as a graffiti artist. And like I said, that's how I met the Beasties. And from there, I...
Now, what was your tag?
Say.
You're Say, okay.
Yeah, it's still floating around out there.
Are there pieces in New York?
Sure.
All right, give me one. All the Beastie fans, if they're coming to New York, be like, there's a Say Adams original.
Well, there's a schoolyard over on Greenwich and Charles Street in the West Village, and you can still see like a giant silver and black Say Blockbuster that I did. But, you know, for most people, if you just Google my name, you know, you'll see a bunch of stuff, because I'm, you know, semi-active again. So
will you ever revisit? Oh wait, you're semi-active?
No, but this is all legal stuff.
Oh, you know, okay.
So, and I should clarify that. Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of times I'll get together with some of my old school graffiti friends and we'll, you know, do a mural project and we'll get a chance to paint some stuff. And, you know, it's nice to be able to do that every once in a while to keep your chops sharp.
Do you ever revisit your old pieces?
Not really.
Like, take Eric out and be like,
no,
yo, baby.
No. Like, too much time has passed and I move way too slow. So, you know, like I said, I started out primarily as a graffiti artist. And then from there, I met Russell Simmons in 1983 when Run DMC was putting out their first record. And he basically gave me an opportunity to start designing posters and flyers for all the artists in his management company. And at the time, he was managing Run DMC, Curtis Blow, Big Daddy Kane, Houdini. And then a few years later, Eric B. and Rakim, De La Soul, oh man, Slick Rick, EPMD.
Like a hip-hop Hall of Fame.
Yeah, the list really, really does go on and on. And so, you know, and obviously, you know, shortly thereafter, he formed Def Jam with Rick Rubin. And so, you know, that's when I made the transition to doing graphic design. And from there, I started designing album covers for LL Cool J and Public Enemy.
So let's go through the album covers.
Oh, man.
Did you have a part in 14 Shots to the Dome?
Yeah.
Okay.
I designed it.
Okay, because that's a Glenn E. Friedman photograph.
That's right. That's a Glenn Friedman photograph. And it's really, you
know, me tell you before you go on, in high school, I redid that album cover and I won second place in an art contest. So thank you, Say.
That's funny. You know, when I think about it, I just remember when we were shooting that, you know, and Glenn is, you know.
Do you think Glenn would do an episode of the Brouhaha?
I don't know. You can certainly ask him. Glenn's got a lot of interesting things to say about a lot of people.
Yes, yeah. If you go to his website, you can see some of that stuff.
Yeah. He's not afraid to tell it like it is. You know, LL is somebody I've known since I was since he was 16. I should clarify that, almost since I was 16. But and you know, like Run DMC and Public Enemy and the Beasties, you know, we were really all one big family. And Rush Artist Management was the management company that was around even before Def Jam. And so together they, you know, had a who's who of hip hop and in some cases R&B as well. But that was basically our clubhouse during the early 80s and, you know, the 90s. We would just hang out there, work there, play there, and everybody got along. And, you know, I kind of think about it in the same vein as the old Motown Soul Review, where all these acts would get on the tour bus and go out and tour the country. And that's what it was like at Def Jam. You know, everybody got along together. You know, it was a loving sort of competitive rivalry, whereas, you know, people would, you know, cheer each other on, but, you know, when they got on stage, it was, you know, every man for himself, and then when people would come off, they'd be, you know, really supportive. So, you know, it was an interesting time to see that happen. And, you know, being there, I got an opportunity to work with all those artists. I would design, you know, T-shirts, posters, flyers. I would do tour backdrops. I mean, you know, I was a one-man, you know, artistic, you know, wrecking crew. And, you know, the thing that was so great about what I did was, you know, I wasn't a producer or a writer or a rapper. I was a visual artist, and so nobody else in our camp did that. So I had that lane all to myself. So whereas, you know, you'd come in the office and there's, you know, 50 people, you know, trying to write a song or trying to go on tour as a rapper or an assistant or a tour manager, I was the only artist that they had. So I got to do everything.
Because I always compare the Beastie Boys to Forrest Gump, because they not only got to see music history, but they experienced it. I mean, old school NYC hardcore, New York City hip hop, on tour with Madonna, American Bandstand, Soul Train. Even in the 90s when bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam were blown up, Beastie Boys were on top of the world. Yeah. You kind of the same way with the old school graffiti in New York City back in the day.
Well, you know, again, that's the advantage of growing up in New York City. I mean, I'm from Queens originally, but, you know, that's just a subway ride away from Lower Manhattan. And when hip hop really kind of took off in the early 80s and, you know, came downtown from, you know, the South Bronx and from Queens and Harlem and, you know, all the other places that it came from, I was there. And so, you know, all those like pioneering graffiti artists were my friends coming up, and the same thing with a lot of the, you know, rap artists. Like, you know, Run DMC comes from the same neighborhood that I'm from. LL Cool J is from the same neighborhood, Tribe Called Quest. But meeting the Beasties early on, I got a chance to experience what it was like from, you know, a downtown, you know, sort of perspective. And, you know, at the time they were a punk band, and so I got to learn about who the Bad Brains were firsthand from them. And so I got a chance to see, you know, what Minor Threat was doing and Murphy's Law and all these other bands. And it was amazing education, you know, from day one. So it was like, you know, being, you know, in London when punk started, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, you're kind of just thrust into this world that you don't know anything about, but you learn really quickly. And, you know, all of a sudden hip-hop is starting to blossom. And the thing that was, you know, really fortunate for them is that they were there. So that's why they get a lot of love from a lot of the old-school pioneers, because they've been putting it down for so long. And they never came at it from a disrespectful point of view. They weren't trying to be something that they were not. They were always doing their thing their way, but it always had a sort of hip-hop twist on it. And if you notice, that's why they always give, you know, thanks to the pioneers. They're always talking about, you know, Spoonie G and the Cold Crush Brothers and Busy B and, you know, Double Trouble and people like that. So I think when people look at them, they realize that, you know what, they pay respect to those folks. And so that's why people, you know, give them their due, because they're not trying to, you know, come in and say, you know, we're better than you, or, you know, we've been doing this longer than you. They're just kind of doing their thing and, you know, paying homage along the way.
Because we're talking about a lot of old school hip hop artists that you grew up with, that the Beastie Boys grew up with. How about artists? Like, did you ever hang out with Andy Warhol?
Actually,
did you guys
I
ever bomb a subway train together?
Well, we didn't do that, but we certainly hung out. And, you know, the thing about that was really interesting is that, like I was saying before, I just saw the new
Basquiat
film that Tamara Davis did. And, you know, for those of you that don't know, Tamara Davis is married to Mike D. And it was really interesting because she really, you know, recreated what it was like in downtown Manhattan in the late 70s and early 80s. And it was just such a beautiful, you know, way that she, you know, just told this rich story. And she incorporated all these characters that were around back then. And so Andy Warhol was one of those people. And for me, being a visual artist, I mean, he is literally like, it's like, you know, Picasso for, you know, my generation.
Yeah.
And so for him to actually be there and to be hanging out and speaking to you, is, you know, there really is nothing better than that. I mean, I can't even imagine. It's, you know, the equivalent of, you know, wanting to be a horn player and you're hanging out with Miles Davis. Like, you know, is there anybody better?
And do you remember a particular Andy Warhol story?
You know what?
I mean, was he aware of, like, the punk scene and the hip-hop and the graffiti?
Sure. I mean, okay. He was there and he was seeking out those people. I mean, you know, he was an icon already, you know, by, you know, the 80s, he's already, you know, a god to certain people. He didn't have to be there. He's there because, you know, he made it his business to stay aware of what was young and what was fresh and what was hot. And so as, you know, graffiti is starting to, you know, blossom and hip-hop music is starting to take off, he wanted to be in that mix. And so, you know, he latched on to what Keith Haring was doing and Jean-Michel was doing. And, you know, he's hanging out in the clubs with, you know, young black and Latino kids trying to absorb that energy.
Good stuff. What is the crown jewel in your arsenal?
You know, to me, it's just working. I don't even think of it as being any one thing. It's just working. And, you know, that's, you know, it's funny. I saw the Joan Rivers documentary a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, Joan Rivers is like, you know, 75 years old or whatever it is. And she's like, you know, the hell with Kathy Griffin, you know. And her thing is, no matter how much she's done, she's not finished doing it yet. And so I kind of look at it the same way. You know, I've done a lot of great things in my career, but I'm always excited about what's happening tomorrow, because, you know, that's what it's about. It's about, you know, the evolution. There's a lot of young people that, you know, might not have heard of half the things that I've done. But if I say, oh, I worked with Jay-Z, they go, oh, I know who he is. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, some other artist, and like, who's that, you know? So
that's why they got to pick up the book.
Yeah.
Definition.
Yeah, the art and design of hip-hop.
DEF in capital letters.
Yeah, it's called Definition, the Art and Design of Hip-Hop. And it really is an education about everything that's happened in the visual arts under the banner of hip-hop. I mean, there's just been such a rich history that's been created already, and it's important for young people to know, you know, who, you know, everybody else is, not just the artists that they love. It's not just, you know, the Beastie Boys or Public Enemy or De La Soul. There are visual artists behind them that have done a lot of great work. And so my idea was to highlight the careers of, you know, some of my graffiti artist friends, like, you know, Lee Quinones and Dondi and Futura 2000, and show people that, you know, we've been working right alongside, you know, the Jay-Z's and the Public Enemies and the LL Cool J's. And, you know, we all deserve credit.
We're going to take one more break, but before we go to a break, what is your favorite font? Can you at least answer that?
I'm a Helvetica guy. I'm a Helvetica guy because, you know, I think about things that are timeless. And the first thing that I learned in graphic design was, you know, when something's great, if you do it and you could come back 10 years later and it doesn't look like you need to, you know, adapt it or update it. So, you know, that was one of the first things that I learned, is that Helvetica is a timeless font.
Feelings on Cooper Black.
I like it.
Yeah, it's a nice...
I like it. You know, it's great if you want to do something retro looking, but you know, it's
because that font is sort of born to that fuzzy iron-on t-shirt.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's right out of the heart of the 70s and the 80s, you know. It's that Dukes of Hazzard and all of that, you know, Welcome Back Kotter, all of that stuff.
I'm usually a Helvetica man, but lately I've been getting into the Rockwell fonts.
Wow.
Thoughts on the Rockwell fonts?
Okay. You know, and it's just funny that you're talking about design, because, you know, I wouldn't even think that, you know, you'd even be aware of that. But, you know, Rockwell is great, too, because it's one of those fonts that you can do a lot of different things with. I mean, you can make things look really retro, and now you can make them look contemporary, because a lot of contemporary design is based on people kind of turning the clock back. And a lot of the kids kind of get it. You know, like, it's cool to make things look like, you know, they were like, you know, 20 or 30 years old. So,
and before we go to break, since we're talking about fonts, and this may be the only time we talk about fonts on the Brouhaha, the last few years, sort of like the scribbled three-dimensional letters, those have been all the rage in car advertising and McDonald's advertising, for Juno movies, for movies featuring Michael Cera. Thoughts on the scribbled three-dimensional font?
You know what?
Font?
I dig it. Like I said, any chance you get an opportunity to, you know, use muted colors, you know, to do things that have a throwback sort of feel is a great thing, because, you know, there was a time when you couldn't push things like that past people because they wanted it to look shiny and they wanted it to look new. And now I think a lot of the people that are hiring creatives kind of understand that, you know, it can have a dated sort of look, and that's what'll bring it up to date. So...
And
I like it.
That concludes our talk on fonts. We will be back with more Brouhaha right after this.
They grew up in New York City, where they soon became bored with high school, and they dropped out to pursue the hardcore punk rock scene. Following their flirtation with punk, they became involved with the emerging rap scene, and their debut album, License to Ill, has been certified as the fastest-selling debut in the history of their label. Now, are these rappers Run DMC, the Beastie Boys, or the Fat Boys? We'll find out when we come back for more Golden Grace.
Yo, check this out. You're listening to the Brouhaha.
All right, Say, we're going to talk Beastie Boys now.
Isn't that what we were doing the whole time?
Now
we're going to get specific.
We're going to get serious now.
Zero in.
Not that we weren't serious before.
Okay.
A couple of episodes ago, we had what was the coolest era in the history of the Beastie Boys.
Wow.
When their music was the coolest, when they looked the coolest, when they act the coolest, in your opinion.
Oh, easily. Yeah, it's so easy, I can't even remember.
Would you like me to tell you when I thought it was?
Yeah.
Because I want to...
Okay.
A little more suspense there.
Okay.
I said it was 1994, around December. I think Check Your Head was so cool, but the Beastie Boys even grew up a little bit into Ill Communication in around 1994, and I actually pinpointed it to their Saturday Night Live performance in December of 1994. The Beastie Boys were never cooler than that.
Wow.
But your answer, is.
I mean, to me, it's definitely the second record. You know, I think that
Paul's Boutique
easily. You know, they grew up, you know, really fast by the time that happened, because you also have to remember that that was the first time they, you know, really kind of moved away from home. I mean, they moved out of New York. That was the first time that, you know, the guys were really exploring what it really means to be away from their families. So they go to L.A. And, you know, although I was still living in New York, I'd been to L.A. a couple of times. When I went out to L.A. and saw that they, you know, all had, you know, their own houses and their own identities and a new crop of friends, it was, you know, they were still kind of into some of the same antics that they were in New York, but now they kind of matured to a point where they weren't afraid to do what they wanted to do by their own, you know, like, you know, ideas and standards. It was, you know, they were really calling their own shots. And to me, that was a lot cooler than, you know, a lot of the stuff that went on before that.
I'll agree with you, but tell me this. They were cooler during the Paul's Boutique era than they were during the Check Your Head or Ill Communication era?
Well, no, I think you're right about that. It got
cooler?
Yeah. You know what Photograph really sums it all up to me? This is like the essence of when they came into their own. Have you ever seen Ricky Powell did a shot of them in front of, like, you know, some hamburger stand, like, in L.A. It was like an all-American burger or something. And when I used it on a T-shirt. And, you know, Adam's got, like, the white knit hat on. It's just such a beautiful photograph. And when I did the T-shirt, I wanted it to look like a 70s iron-on. So, I did the whole thing where, you know, it's got the border around it. And it's, like, you know, the glitter, the same way the Farrah Fawcett, you know, shirts had. And I really wanted it to look like a vintage, like, 70s, like I said, Dukes of Hazzard sort of, you know, style T-shirt. And the response to those shirts was, you know, so amazing. And that's how I knew that I really kind of hit the nail on the head. But that photograph really spoke to that time. Like, you know, Yauch with the shades and, you know, the trucker hat. And, oh.
All right.
So great.
During the Brouhaha episode where we talked about the coolest era, I kind of argued that Paul's Boutique wasn't necessarily an era. Although a lot of stuff happened in the G spot, and a lot of stuff happened in the studio, but there wasn't any tour. And I think to have an era, you need to have an accompanying tour.
You know, that's true, but, you know, you have to remember that, you know, they matured in a way. Like, I mean, you listen to that record, and it was like, you know, just the stuff that the Dust Brothers came up with and the stuff that they came up with, it was miles away from, you know, the stuff that went on during License to Ill. And to me, it was like a world away. You know, I'd come out there and I would see the things that they were doing and the people that they were hanging out with. You know, I remember meeting River Phoenix, and, you know, he was just somebody that I knew from, you know, watching movies. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm becoming friendly with this guy, and he was a really, really cool guy. And that was the kind of thing that they were into. Like, people would just gravitate towards them, and, you know, like, major movie stars would just lose their minds being in their presence. Like, every time I turn around, Woody Harrelson's at a show or Leo's at a show. You know, people would just lose their minds being in their presence. And that was one of the things that reminded me of kind of how cool they were. Because in New York, you know, you don't really get that so much. You know, people, everybody's kind of doing their thing here. But in L.A., you know, it's all about mystique and illusion. And, you know, they had a lot of that when they came out there.
Best Beastie show you ever saw live? Or one of them?
I've been on tour with them for so many years. You know, the thing that I think about the most when I think about the best show, I think about the fact that they don't treat playing in front of, like, a stadium any different than they treat an arena, any different than they treat a club date. I mean, they really prepare for them in such an intense way. I mean, I think that that's the thing that I kind of connect with the most, that, you know, they're going to give, you know, the same quality performance for, you know, people in a club that they do in an arena. And I just think it's so amazing to me that they don't, you know, kind of turn it on and turn it off. They just go out there and they just, they do it. Every time I look at that crowd, I'm thinking, aren't you petrified? Like, these people came to see you, you know, and they just, you know, kind of go out there and they just do it.
How serious do they take their live show?
Are you kidding? They take it very seriously.
Kind of take us behind the scenes, because if you think about it, I mean, these guys are bouncing for an hour and a half.
Yeah, well, the thing that, you know, I find really fascinating, and I was telling a friend this the other day when, you know, I saw a documentary about a band and they were getting ready for a show, and so they were talking about, you know, this one specific date when they came through their hometown and they were doing all this prep work because they wanted that to be really special. That's what the Beasties do whenever they come to Madison Square Garden. You know, they put a lot of time and energy into those sort of shows because, you know, that's when your real family and your friends are really watching. And certainly all the fans that have come up with you over the years, you know that, you know, you're coming to your hometown. And so what they end up doing is, you know, they'll spend days just like dwindling down to make sure the set list is right. And, you know, it's not just throwing in a bunch of songs from License to Ill. It's, you know, okay, you know, we played here before and we got this sort of response from this song, so we're going to incorporate that. But we want to do something, you know, really new for the people that, you know, might only be familiar with the last record. And so, you know, they put a lot of time and energy into that. But also, you know, the wardrobe, you know, they'll sit down with the wardrobe stylist and, you know, weeks in advance, like, you know, we're in Europe and they're talking about what's going to happen, you know, when they get to the Garden. And you really, really want it to be special. And so, you know, they'll focus on what the outfit is going to be, you know, where the family and friends are going to sit, you know, how can we do something for the fans that, you know, hasn't happened before. And so that's why, you know, when they came up with the idea of doing the film, you know, Yao decided, okay, you know, we're going to film this all in New York City, and we're going to make sure that, you know, only hardcore fans get these cameras because we want it to be a special moment. I mean, that's something that is really more for the fans than anybody else. You know, but one of the things that I think about when we were on the License to Ill tour and we came to the Garden for the first time, and I remember that was a sign that they had really made it. And you have to understand that, you know, there's nothing in my mind crazier than aspiring to play an arena show when you're a small band, because you got to remember the Beastie Boys come from a punk rock background. So the idea that anybody would ever set foot on Madison Square Garden stage is insane.
Let alone with just like a pair of turntables.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. The idea that, you know, that's your goal. You're thinking that you're going to rock the Garden. Good luck. It ain't going to happen. And so, you know, they talk about, you know, playing at the Garden. It says, you know, while you're at the Garden working 9 to 5, you know, well, we're at the Garden, help me. It's
well, you're at your job working 9 to 5.
Right. It's like when you're at your job working 9 to 5, the Beastie Boys at the Garden, cold kicking it live. It's just the nuttiest thing that you ever want to say. It's like, you're a regular working stiff. I'm going to be playing the Madison Square Garden.
Obviously, there's some type of athleticism involved in doing a show like that. How do they prepare for that?
You know what? We play a lot of, you know, like team sports. And when I say team, it's, you know, all our, you know, friends from the neighborhood. We play a lot of basketball. And, you know, people probably know that if they've ever seen some of the videos.
And in 98... a new wrinkle was added to the live show, Mixmaster Mike. Now, do you know why there was never an official announcement made about Hurricane?
No. You know what? I think that it's like anything else. I think when you kind of come to a crossroads with a friend, you kind of go in one direction and they go in another. I don't think that it was ever a thing where they wanted to kind of tell people. I think at the end of the day, they are the band, and I think that that's what the record company understands, and that's what the fans understand. And they, you know, if they got out there, you know, they could put on a show with no DJ. I mean, I've seen them do that. where, you know, there have been situations where, you know, they just had to go out there, you know, and do a bunch of songs a cappella if they had to, and they can do it, you know, and they'll use the audience's music.
Because I think a lot of fans were just like, why did Hurricane leave? And that sort of made Mixmaster Mike sort of like a sacrificial lamb.
You know what? The interesting thing about that to me is I think it's just about change. And I think, you know, everybody was ready for a change and it sort of just happened. And, you know, it's like, you know, when Eric Bobo was, you know, on percussion and then, you know, you wake up one day and then Fredo is there. And all of a sudden you think, wow, there's something, you know, new and exciting about the Beastie Boys, and you might not be able to put your finger on it. And then all of a sudden you see, you know, Mark back there doing something really crazy. And you're like, oh, okay. And then all of a sudden, you know, you see Mixmaster Mike, and it's like a breath of fresh air. It's like, you know, those guys getting a new outfit or something, or a brand new microphone. You're like, something new is happening. And I think the thing that's so great about Mike is that he makes the guys, you know, better, because all of a sudden they have to be on top of their game because they don't know what he's going to do.
Well, like now in 2010, it makes perfectly good sense. And I'll even listen back to my old bootlegs and I'm like, how did I listen to the Beastie Boys without these beat changes?
So
he definitely adds another dimension to the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to think that he's been in the band now for 12 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that longer than Hurricane?
Well,
he went from what, like 80?
Yeah, I mean,
85-ish, 86-ish to 98.
Yeah. And what's so great about it is that Mike is like a real technician. Like, his thing is he's got to stay on top of what's happening in, you know, in the world of DJing and beats. And, you know, he understands that he could easily be in a position where, if he was asleep at the wheel, somebody would be, you know, like on his heels looking for that position, because, you know, that's the way it is out there. There's always somebody younger trying to be better, trying to be, you know, the next Mixmaster Mike. So you got to stay on top of your game. And I think that's also why the guys were excited, because it gave them an opportunity to show people that, you know what, even though we put out, you know, a bunch of records, we're not above taking it to another place. And so, you know, believe me, I was as skeptical as the next person when he first came on board. But the minute I saw what he could do, I thought, you know what, that's what the future looks like.
A lot of people ask me when the Hot Sauce Committee Part 1 album is going to come out. I'm like, I couldn't tell you.
You know what?
Do you know anything?
It's easy. I don't know. And I think that...
Have you heard the album?
You know what? Believe it or not, I have not. And the only reason I have not is because, you know, I have this thing where I don't want to hear something and then have it be released later and then have it, you know, seem old to me. So, you know, I mean, certainly I could say, hey, you know what, I want to, you know, sit down and give the record a listen. But, you know, I want to be surprised like everybody else. And then that way also, if they go back and they decide to edit things or, you know, tweak things or change things, you know, I won't have this sort of backward sort of perspective that it's not as good as it was before or it's better than it was before. I just, you know, I want to be excited right along with everybody else.
Do you know what they're doing with it right now? Like, do you know if they will go back and and maybe add some more tracks or
This is what I know. Although the guys are out pursuing, like, you know, individual projects and doing other things, they're always screwing around with the music. You know, it's never just sitting there. You know, every time I turn around, you know, Yauka is, you know, tweaking something, or Adam's doing something, or Mike is doing something, you know, and they do it collectively and individually. So I think that when they're finally ready to release it, it'll be, you know, whatever the combination of all of them, you know, tweaking it and fooling around with it will be. But, you know, I'm sure they're going to make an announcement at some point, because, you know, they know that people want to know what's going on. And, you know, certainly everybody knows that, you know, a lot of this centers around, you know, Yauk feeling, you know, healthy and, you know, ready to get back out there and do his thing. And when that's, you know, that time comes, they'll do it.
And how much do they pay attention to the fans? Do you know if they ever read the boards or?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, the funny thing is, Yauk was the one that kind of, I think, originally figured out that that was a great way to communicate with people. And certainly they, you know, they monitor everything that's going on. And that way, you know, if somebody's doing something or saying something negative on there, you know, they jump in there and they deal with it. And they have administrators that kind of keep an eye on those things. And, you know, they all look at it. You know, they don't say anything, but they certainly look at it. You know, they know what's happening.
So if there was like a kid who said, yeah, I'd really like to hear Professor Booty and Unite in the set list.
Well, certainly.
They might listen
to
that.
Sure. I mean, that's how things end up in the set list. You know, when they used to do that thing on tour where they would, you know, send Jamie Billet out and interview folks before the show and get requests, then they go back and they say, okay, you know what? X amount of people said they want to hear this song. Let's put it in the set list.
I heard that kid makes a mean set of ribs.
Yes, he does. Jamie Billet is an amazing grill master.
And for some reason, I'm having flashbacks of you in a yellow blazer.
That's funny. You know, I learned that the hard way, that he's an amazing, amazing grill master. And you know, the one thing I will say that's a lot of fun is that we have a little summer softball league, and Jamie Billet is our grill master whenever we have our team barbecues. So,
but only Ad Rock is a carnivore, right? Out of the Beasties,
you know, I would assume that Yauk isn't eating too much barbecue these days, and I know Mike isn't, but yeah, I think Adam is the, you know, the ribs guy these days.
Do you ever eat any Tammy D cooking?
Yeah, I think I have. I mean, unfortunately, nothing sticks out because, you know, like I said, you know, her and Mike are, you know, doing a lot of vegetables and things like that. And so, you know, if I eat them, they don't kind of stay with me the way, you know, red meat does, because I'm just, you know, I'm a real barbecue guy. So,
because I remember when you made the cheeseburger shirt.
Yeah.
I was asking you about this. Was a few years ago, and you said it was a tough sell on the Beastie.
Yeah, it was.
Ad Rock went for it, but it was really tough getting that cheeseburger shirt out.
Well, it was really funny because what I remember is that Mike, you know, wasn't happy with it. I mean, he thought it was a great design, but he was like, you know, I don't know if that really represents where I'm, the way I'm living these days. And I just said to him, I was like, imagine it as a veggie burger. He's like, okay. And so, you know, he kind of just went with it. Adam loved it. Yauk was kind of like, you know, whatever the guys want, I'm okay with. And so it was like kind of one yes, one no, and then one in the middle. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do? And so once I said the thing about the veggie burger, it was more like, you know, he let me do a test and we put it out. And the fans loved it, and so that's how it, you know, got its legs, and it decided that, you know.
And it sold well, too.
Sure, it's one of their biggest sellers, you know. Very happy about that.
Say gets the last laugh.
I drew that thing by hand. It was a lot of hard work.
I like the color, too.
So for the record, it could easily be a veggie burger.
Right.
It, you know.
Doesn't have to be hamburger.
No, it doesn't.
And I don't know if you've listened to the Brouhaha, but we have a contest called 20 Questions. I'm not going to put you on the hot seat.
No, I'd be amazed. I'd love to. You know,
you want to do it?
I'd love to.
All right, we're gonna end this episode with Say Adams playing 20 Questions.
Okay.
There is a prize, too.
Oh, wow.
But I don't have to burden you with it.
No.
It is a Beastie diorama that I created in the summer of 2002. And if you would like to see a picture of it, just go to thebrouhaha.podbean.com, scroll down. But I don't know what you would do with a diorama. Because it seems like you'd probably have a lot of artwork hanging around the apartment, and you wouldn't want more clutter.
Yeah. No, I do have a lot of it, but it's all like in, you know, files and drawers and stuff put away.
So you could use a diorama?
You know.
Or you could just answer the questions, and then it's up to you if you want to keep it or not.
Well, what I end up doing is I'd probably give it to, you know, one of the kids on the board, because, you know, over the years I've met a lot of them, and, you know, as a lot of people know, I've, you know, found myself befriending people like, you know, Rusty, you know, Pootie Tang. And, you know, it's always nice to kind of, you know, see those guys at shows and stuff. And, you know, that's the thing that I get the biggest kick out of, is being able to, you know, hook somebody up with tickets that, you know, doesn't have tickets to get into a show or something. And so things like that happen a lot. And so that's one of the things that, you know, I'll do all the time.
And when I retire from the biz, because right now I'm still in the biz, but I may need that connection.
Well,
so don't forget about me, Say.
You can call me anytime.
Okay. We'll talk, though. We're going to take one more break, and we will end this episode of The Brouhaha with Say Adams playing 20 Questions.
Welcome back to Oscilloscope Sports Team Barbecue Talk. I am Dan Harper, and to my left is
Hank Kingsley.
None other than, yes.
Yo, you know who I'm living with right about here, right? Beastie Boy. Yep. Full effect right about now. I got my Mella over here, Mike D. Cool Ad Rock. MCA. Hurricane got clouds. Knocking suckers' heads out. What's up, y'all? How y'all doing?
All right, good. All right. Everything's
back in dosage.
Oh, yeah, dude. You're listening to the Brouhaha.
We are back on the Brouhaha, the special Say Adams edition of the Brouhaha. He said he was down for it. He wants to play 20 questions.
What do I have to lose? The worst that could happen is I don't get the free gift.
All right. But you wouldn't be afraid if you went out on question number 4?
No, not at all.
Okay. And there are some rules.
Okay.
Very basic rules.
Okay.
If you get stumped along the way,
right,
there are 3 opportunities to get multiple choice answers.
Oh, cool.
A,
okay.
B, C, and D.
So I can get a lifeline.
Kind of.
Okay.
And other than that, you have to answer 20 consecutive questions correctly.
Well, that would be the idea, I would guess. There's an episode of The Honeymooners where Ralph is on the show called The $99,000 Answer. And he's studying for weeks and weeks and weeks. And they ask him the first song. It's like a Cole Porter song or something. And that was a song that he would warm up to. Ed Norton would play that. And he knew everything. And they ask him the first question and he doesn't know it. And he's like, they're like, so long. And he's like, no.
I hope that doesn't happen to you.
Me either. Believe me.
All right.
Wow.
Question number 1. What Beastie Boys album does the song Groove Holmes appear on?
Oh, that's Check Ahead.
Yes.
And you know, the only reason why I know that is because I visualize the back cover. And I would just see
And that's a great font.
Yeah.
Speaking of fonts. Question number 2. In the 1980s, what Beastie Boy was known for wearing a Volkswagen logo around his neck?
That should have been the first one. That's Mike D.
Mike D is correct.
Well, you know what's really funny? This is like where it gets embarrassing. Just the other day, I was looking through my archives and I found some old slides of me and my son Eric, and he was wearing Mike D's Volkswagen chain. And so I put those aside because I'm going to blow them up and make prints from them, because he would definitely get a kick out of seeing that now that he's a...
Is that chain still around somewhere, like the sardine can?
That I don't know about. I'm pretty sure it probably, is in a crate somewhere with the other stuff from, the License to Ill tour.
Where do they keep their stuff? Like in their apartment, or is there like a special Beastie storage facility somewhere?
Yeah, they have storage facilities in New York and in New Jersey, and all that License to Ill stuff is still in storage from like whatever it is, like 20, some odd years ago. And funny enough, we went on a little road trip. It was probably like 2 years ago. It was like me, Adam, and our friend Nadia. And Yauk gave us the video camera. And we went and taped the trip. And we went to the storage facility. Everything is still intact. They went and rolled out all the backdrops. And, we plugged in, the hydraulic, penis.
Oh, the wiener is still there.
Works. And, it was crazy to think that all this stuff is still sitting there. Literally collecting dust.
Question number 3? Oh, yeah, we're only at number 3. The Tibetan Freedom Concert, held in Randall's Island, New York City, what unique onstage attire did the Beastie Boys wear?
Oh, see, that's not easy. Oh, that's hard. And the thing that's really embarrassing about this is that I was there. But
let me give you tips.
Okay.
Mike D had braids in his hair, and Ad Rock had a really big afro. And this, I believe, was Hurricane's last set with the group.
Oh, you mean the jumpsuits? Is that what you're asking about? The multicolored jumpsuits?
I ask, you answer.
But in addition to that, you mean?
No. This is a very simple... Oh, and I should also point out that the first 5 questions sort of simple, so you shouldn't think too much about those.
Okay.
Jumpsuit,
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
All right. You're going to say something else before I cut
you
off?
Oh, I was going to say the reason why I couldn't remember was because when I saw that U2 was on the bill, I got distracted. And so all I wanted to do that day was to meet U2. And I got there late and they were already on stage. And so that was like, you know, my one like, you know, like failed moment because I've been a U2 fan forever. And so once the guys kind of, you know, befriended the guys in U2, it's like I felt like I had died and gone to heaven because then I could literally walk right up to Bono and the Edge and like kick it. And so.
All right. So you're 3 for 3.
Wow.
Question number 4. What is the opening track and lead single from To the Five Boroughs?
Oh, see, this is hard.
See, there's fans listening right now and be like, there's no way Say's going to go to one.
No, but you know, that's hard. It's not Open Letter.
It's not.
Is this one I could get
Yeah, sure.
Okay, sure.
All right. A is So What You Want. B, To Check It Out. C, That's It, That's All. Or D, Right Now, Now. Opening track and lead single from To the Five Boroughs.
I'm gonna go with Right Now.
You didn't say final answer. So, and I'm enjoying
you want
these
me,
stories.
You want me to say Check It Out?
And I'm enjoying
it, it would
these
probably
stories.
It would probably be Check It Out.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah.
Yep, to Check It Out. Absolutely. Number 5. Was the music video Sabotage a Nathaniel Hornblower or a Spike Jonze joint?
Spike Jonze.
You are correct.
I know.
Go to question number 6. Finish the following hook, which we had a little trouble with the cold kicking at the her.
While you're
at your job working 9 to 5.
Believe me, I know it. If I focus, I know it.
Beastie Boys at the Garden, cold right. Kicking it live. All right. Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, and Staten. From the Battery to the Top of Manhattan.
See, this is it's funny that you break it there, because that's where it gets tricky, because it's I know it's like Asian, Indian, something.
All right. Because some of these questions unlock little Say Adam stories. I'll say Asian, Middle Eastern, and Latin.
That's the whole thing.
No, there's one more.
Black, white, and Latin, isn't that? It's like
Asian, Middle Eastern, and Latin. You said black, white, the city we're in.
Manhattan.
No, the city we're
from
in.
From the top of Manhattan, isn't it?
We're in New York. Black, yeah. White, New York.
This is so embarrassing. It's.
You make it happen.
Yeah. Oh, black, white, New York, we make it happen.
All right. I'll give you credit for that. Only because you invited me down here today to do this podcast.
And I really do know it. It's just, you know.
It's
and
tough.
You want to know something? That's actually one of my favorite songs from that album because it, you know, it was, they just did such a good job like threading all the history of New York into like a you know, 2.5 minute song. It's crazy.
That was the one that blew me away.
I never
when I first listened to the album
get misty when I think about the Beastie Boys, and that was one thing that, you know, they would perform after 9/11, and it was just like I would just get so emotional. It was just wow.
Little Dead Boys hook in there too.
Yeah.
All right, I'm not going to give you any more. yeah, I kind of gave you that one, but we march on to number 7. In the music video Triple Trouble, how does Sasquatch initially locate the Beastie Boys?
Wow, that's hard.
He sees them on TV, they're on the red carpet show.
They
diss him on the red carpet.
Am I supposed to say yes to that?
No, I'm just...
Was that
just,
one of the three?
No.
I thought he was watching TV.
He was. And what device did he use to locate the Beastie Boys?
Oh, this is bad. I'm just gonna say, is this another one where I could?
Sure. You know, do you want the
Yeah, the lifeline.
All right. A. He uses his animal sense. B. He uses MapQuest on a computer. C. A phone call from MC Search of third base tips him off. Or D. A handwritten note from Russell Simmons.
I would think MapQuest.
You are correct. Wow. You have one more multiple choice option.
Oh, and then I'm on my own
and
after.
You're
that.
On your own.
Oh, wow. And these are the easy ones.
These are the easy ones. Question number 8. Who is not shouted out in the album Paul's Boutique, which was your favorite era, so you should know the shout-outs.
Okay.
A, Bruce Willis. B, Mario Andretti. C, Fred Savage. Or D, J.D. Salinger. Who is not shouted out in the album Paul's Boutique?
I would probably say Fred Savage.
Will you definitely say it?
Yeah, I'm going to say Fred.
You are correct. Fred Savage, not shouted out in Paul's Boutique.
Okay.
Number 9, what two-song medley did the Beastie Boys perform the last time they appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman?
I have to say what it is?
Yep.
Wow, I don't get the
You can if you want to. Do you want it? All right, so this is it. You've used your 3 in the first 9 questions.
Okay.
A, Shazam into Root Down. B, 3MCs into So What You Want. C, Shadrack into Triple Trouble. Or D, Boom and Granny into Cookie Puss. The last time they appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman.
It's, what was it? Was it 3MCs into Triple Trouble? Is that what
you said? So What You Want.
I would think that it would be 3MCs into So What You Want. That's my final answer.
That's it?
And you know what? And I was there, so if I got that wrong, that would again be very bad.
And that was, the Beastie Boys did an overdub.
Yeah.
In that performance.
Yeah.
Now, do you know why they did? I know because they did the one verse twice.
No, but I think it there was some technical difficulty, and I think at the last minute that was the way the folks at Letterman decided to resolve it. Because, you know, I remember there was something going on in the city that day, and I don't remember what it was, but there was some big thing happening.
What happened?
I don't remember.
It was a cold winter day.
But you know, in New York, there's always something going on.
What a cryptic answer. Because it was weird, because when they showed it on Letterman, the Beastie Boys were doubling up on the vocals where they shouldn't have been doubling up on.
Yeah.
And I remember Mike D said Sweet Lou, and the Sweet Lou didn't make the telecast, and I was confused. And then I listened to it back. I used my BC sense, and I'm like, they did an overdub. Yeah.
All I remember is that it was really cold in the studio.
Because I was there.
Yeah.
No top 10 that day.
Wow.
The only time I was at David Letterman and no top 10. Maybe that was a strange thing that happened in New York that day.
Maybe. Was Ben Stiller the other guest on the show?
I don't remember.
It was either him or like Will Ferrell or something.
Yeah, I don't remember who was on. All right. Well, we march on to question number 10.
Okay.
This has something to do with album covers. It's going to be tough, though.
Okay.
So I may be out of your apartment.
Okay. No. The worst I could do is get it wrong.
All right. But either way, the podcast will be over, and then I'll have to leave unless you want to adopt me or something.
Right.
True or false? On the following album covers, Check Your Head, Hello Nasty, Sounds of Science, Solid Gold Hits, The Mix-Up, and Hot Sauce Committee Part 1, the Beastie Boys never appear in the same sequence from left to right.
Wow.
Now you had a hand in one of those album covers.
Yeah, but you know what? If I had to think about, oh my goodness. See, are you telling me that somebody really knows the answer to that? I'm going to say that, so the answer is whether or not they're always in the same sequence. I would think that they would not be.
Wait, the Beastie Boys never appear in the same sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning it's like Mike D, Ad-Rock, MCA, MCA.
I would think that they would have. At some point, they would have even accidentally. Because I know that.
You're saying they would accidentally have been in the same sequence.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, I know it's a weird question.
Yeah, yeah.
You are actually correct.
I know.
And believe it or not, it only happens once.
Wow.
The sequencing on Check Your Head and Solid Gold Hits.
Wow. Because I know that, you know, when we were doing Hello Nasty, they're not kind of paying attention to who's where. But, you know, whenever we did it, we kind of switched up the order just, you know, for the sake of, you know, getting some sort of creative symmetry. you know, one, you know, Yao could be in the middle or Adam would be on the side. But, you know, for the most part, there's never any rule about who stands where.
Because you never said, well, Mike D's in the middle and check your head so Mike D doesn't get to be in the middle in this picture.
I don't think, and I'd never even thought about that until you said that. And I know that they've never thought about it.
Only happened once, though.
Wow, that's really
something to think about.
Yeah.
Question number 11. The song Mullet Head is about what headline-grabbing figure?
Oh, I have to figure it out.
Who had many TV, made-for-TV movies made about him? Had a mullet.
You know, the only person I'm thinking of is little what's-her-name's father.
I believe he's from Long Island. I believe they made, when this incident happened, they made 3 television movies about it.
Oh, Joey, is it Joey Buttafuoco? It's like, you couldn't make it any easier.
If anyone here is listening to the Brouhaha, you will not have it this easy on 20 questions.
This is so embarrassing.
All right. you're getting through, though. And by the way, you're out of multiple choice options.
Okay, good. Now I want to stand on my own 2 feet.
Question number 12.
I'm tired of you carrying me.
Yes. Why are fans asked not to take flash photography of the Beastie Boys at shows?
Oh, that's easy, because Adam has a thing about the flash bulbs that kind of bothers his eyes and stuff.
Yes, it could trigger a epileptic seizure.
Yeah.
Yes. Big Earl many times would...
But people don't listen.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
I saw Big Earl, by the way, doing security with New Kids on the Block.
Ah, were you at the show?
No.
I had to interview them for work, yeah.
Tell, Donnie.
Question number 13. What Beastie hit does not appear on Solid Gold Hits? No Sleep Till Brooklyn, Hey Ladies, Brass Monkey, or Fight for Your Right to Party?
Oh, that's easy. Fight for Your Right to Party. No, that does appear. Give me the choices again.
No Sleep Till Brooklyn, right. Hey Ladies, Brass Monkey, Fight for Your Right to Party.
I would probably say Hey Ladies then.
Final
answer.
Say, it's been a pleasure having you on the Brouhaha today.
That one's wrong?
That one is wrong.
What's the answer?
No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
So is that the way it works? Once you get it wrong, then you don't have to...
You're done.
Oh.
You're done.
Once you get it wrong, then that's it.
That's it.
How far do we go?
That was question number 13.
That's not
respectable.
Bad.
Yeah,
that's not fair.
No, very
respectable. Even though you threw me a bunch. Yeah, that was a tricky one though, because you'd have to really kind of know the lineup. And I was thinking, okay, they never play Fight for Your Right, so maybe that's it. But then I thought, okay, it was the greatest hits today. We put that on there, and I was like, oh, that was tricky.
But say,
yes,
thank you
for
answering pretty much everything I had to ask today on this episode of the Brouhaha.
This is fun. It was only 2 hours longer than you said.
I think I said 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah. But
I owe you that time on the back end in life. If you ever need that time back, you guys let me know. I can do some work around the house or something.
Yeah, that would be fun.
So thank you, Say.
I can be a reoccurring guest on the show.
Would you?
Yeah.
And we'll keep it to 15 to 20 minutes
next time.
So for Say Adams, my name is Jim Shear, and we will see yins later. That's all there is. Come on.
Yo, we're going to end it on a 1-2-3 note. Are you ready? 1-2-1-2-3.
Guarantee we bring the brouhaha.
It's a brouhaha.